From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislative session. I'm John Pimble. Last week...
We're now in 2017. We've got 275,000 Iowans that have a permit to carry weapons.
Representative Matt Winstittle makes his case in a committee to expand gun rights.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill for freedom's sake.
Now, during week 9, this bill comes to the Iowa House in the form of an omnibus bill, a bill that combines smaller related bills into one package. On Tuesday morning, before debate in the House begins, he meets in a room at the Capitol with members of the Iowa Firearms Coalition.
We have gotten this bill to a place where I didn't even expect us to get to as far as the freedoms that we have in here. And this sets us up for future successes. This sets us up so we can come back next year and continue to get our freedoms back that have been encroached upon over generations.
There are many aspects to this bill, so many that I think we could do a podcast about Second Amendment rights in Iowa. Let me point this out now. The Iowa legislature has a website, and it offers audio and video streaming of every single chamber debate. And when you find a subject of interest, I encourage you to watch long portions of it there on any subject. It is absolutely fascinating. Here on this show, Under the Golden Dome, we look for highlights. So if this bill makes it to the governor's desk, which if previous majority party legislation this year is any indication, it probably will, there are going to be changes for how Iowans use or carry their guns. These laws make every effort to say a person that carries a firearm must have a valid permit. But that permit doesn't include a photo of the person authorized to have the weapon. During the House debate, Representative Sharon Steckman enters an amendment that would require the Department of Public Safety to include a photo on a permit to carry.
If an officer pulls someone over and for some reason asks to see their carry permit, how is that officer going to determine when he sees that permit that that's the person that has that gun, that's the real person? I mean, if it had Sharon Steckman on it, would they know if that's me or if it's someone else?
Representative Steckman compares it to the proposed voter ID law, which in many cases, not all, as we'll hear later in the show, requires a photo ID to vote. She wants the same standard to be applied to a gun permit.
I think it's only fair if you're requiring one for one constitutional amendment that you should require it for another.
She withdraws her amendment. Another amendment is from Representative Mary Masher. This allows bodies like a city council to prohibit the carrying of guns to public meetings.
Cities and counties often debate and discuss controversial issues at their meetings. Emotions can run high, and those elected officials should be able to pass policies that protect themselves and others in the community who may be attending those meetings.
This amendment also removes a portion that allows a person to sue a city or county for not being able to carry a firearm to such a place if it is prohibited. Representative Timothy Cassina asks Representative Winstittle to yield to questions about the language in his bill saying someone can sue if they can't bring a gun with a permit to a city council meeting.
So if my city council says I do not want guns within the city hall, they can be sued for that. Is that what you're saying?
If a person,
I'm just trying to get clarification on this.
If a person can prove that they are adversely affected and that that rule or resolution or motion or whatever it might be from the city level, if they can prove that to a judge that that's in violation of 724.28, which has been on the books for 27 years, then yes, they could seek injunctive and declarative relief.
Can you explain adversely affected?
That would be up to the individual to define how they are adversely affected. They would have to make the case before the judge, and I don't claim to be in the legal profession, so I don't know what a judge would look at and say, yes, that's adversely affected, or no.
That's would you give me an example of what you would say would be adversely affected, in your opinion only?
I believe that if a city government were passing restrictions on the free carrying of firearms from law-abiding or by law-abiding citizens, that could have an adverse effect. If there was a crime that happened there and someone had been disarmed before they walked into that meeting and were not able to defend themselves, that would be an adverse effect. But there's many other ways we could go down that path.
Thank you. I guess the only thing I think about is Mount Pleasant on December 10th, 1986. When we had one dead, two wounded, I think this is where a lot of the time, and we brought precautions within this state at that time. We started bumping up security in different areas. To not have a local control issue, to not be able to take care of our city council, to make sure they are safe, to make the decisions that they need, then I just find that wrong.
In an effort to define what kind of weapon with a permit can be carried where, Representative Mary Wolf asks Representative Winschittle about the bill's provisions allowing pistols to be brought to the state capitol and if it includes long guns like a rifle.
As we stand here today, is it fair for me to tell the people of Iowa who are listening to this discussion that if the bill passes and they have a valid permit to carry, they will be able to carry their long guns, rifles, whatever the terminology is, open across their shoulders up here to the Capitol into these chambers?
No. The requirement would be that they conceal a handgun, pistol, or revolver.
Well, what about their long guns? What do they do with those? Leave them home?
We have not addressed long guns in this. The way that we have this crafted is that the rules that govern the Capitol would be written in a way that they could not restrict the concealment and carrying of a handgun if someone has a valid permit. We have not addressed long guns.
Author of this amendment that would allow city councils to ban guns, Representative Mary Masher, asks Representative Winschittle about the difference between guns being allowed in a city council meeting versus a public school board meeting.
What are the preemptions in the bill, in the law? What government entities or political subdivisions are preempted?
In this, under the statute, it's all political subdivisions. In the bill, it's cities, counties, and townships.
So are school districts included, school board meetings?
No, ma'am.
Are they a government entity? Are they elected officials?
Yes, they are. In Chapter 724, we already have a weapons-free zone for K-12 education, both public and private.
I'm talking about at their actual board meetings, which may or may not be in a school building. They're okay. in a separate board office, not necessarily a school building itself. Would they be exempt from the law, preempt?
If they had domain over that local structure, potentially yes.
So it's okay for a school board to have a public meeting and ban guns and not allow them, but it's not okay for a city council or a county board of supervisors, is that correct?
It would depend on where they're having that meeting.
The location's the issue? If it's school district property.
If it's school district property, they're already covered under the law.
So my question to you is, why would you have a different law for a school board than a city council or a county supervisor's board?
That differential has been in law long before I've been a legislator, because 724-28's been here for 27 years, and we've had the weapons-free zones on schools in 724-4A and 4B for a long time.
I think you're missing my point. You're picking winners and losers in this particular bill, and you're saying that school districts, and if I'm not mistaken, are community college boards as well, are they exempt and preempted from this bill?
They do not fall under the definition of a city, county, or township.
What about the Board of Regents?
They do not fall under the definition.
So, do you see what I'm saying? They're also government entities that make public decisions. They are a public board, and you are saying for those entities, we will not and we will prohibit guns. But if it's a local city council or a supervisor's group, they are not allowed that same opportunity. Is that correct?
The way that I'm going to answer the question is very simple. If I had my druthers, a law-abiding Iowan would be able to carry a firearm wherever they are lawfully present. In order to address the concerns that were brought forth when we had the broad discussion on preemption, this was a solution that we came to. This is in keeping with the intent of the law that was passed 27 years ago.
The amendment is voted down. Another controversial part of this bill is how it redefines Iowa's current Stand Your Ground law. Representative Mary Wolf says she supports much of what is in this omnibus bill, but she votes against it because she says there are aspects of the law she can't get behind. One of them is how this bill will redefine Iowa's current Stand Your Ground law.
And so my concern is that somebody, some organizations, have been disseminating completely untruthful interpretations of the law to gin up support for a bill which does away with any requirement to weigh the cost-benefit of walking away if you're able to do so with absolutely no risk to yourself or others. That is the only duty to retreat in current law. If you can do so 100% safely, you need to do so. And good Lord, how reasonable is that, right? Instead, under this bill, that's gone. So doesn't matter what happens. So the point is, it offends me when people suggest that I don't believe that people should be able to defend themselves and use deadly force when deadly force is required. You can do that under current law. This bill confuses the issue, and I do not believe that the education is going to happen because it hasn't happened in the past. And there are provisions in Division 10 that do, for all intents and purposes, result in a shoot first, think later, in that they create a legal presumption that deadly force is reasonable under certain under certain circumstances, even if a person does not have a reasonable belief that that's the case. And that's complicated, but that's because this stuff is complicated. That's what it does.
Representative Matt Wichtittle stands firm by his bill.
A stand your ground measure is that a person has no duty to retreat from any place they are lawfully present.
He says this particular provision is something he has been trying to get through the legislature since his first year here a decade ago.
This is about protecting the Iowan who actually finds himself in this terrible situation, so that if they make a decision and they use force, including deadly force, and they are justified in doing that, that they don't find themselves being prosecuted and litigated for months on end, only to be acquitted and said, hey, guess what? The criminal justice system works.
The bill passes 58-39. Soon it will come before the Senate. This is the weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble. It was a very active week at the Capitol. Before Tuesday afternoon's passage of the gun bill, there were four public hearings, and yes, this is a higher than usual number in a 36-hour period of time for public hearings. They were about reorganizing the Des Moines Waterworks, modifying workers' compensation, prohibiting counties from setting their own minimum wage, and voter ID. Voter ID is the bill Secretary of State Paul Pate wants. He has been advocating for it for months. Last month, on February 7th, Secretary Pate was a guest on our talk show, River to River, with host Ben Kiefer. Secretary Pate says one reason he introduced the bill is to improve the integrity of the voting system in Iowa.
Elections equipment itself is a decade old or more. It has not been touched. And when you're looking at today's elections processes, so much of it is mobile. And you have 40% of the voters voting absentee. You have a significant number of people registering to vote on election day. And these are all good things because we see ourselves as one of the top states in the country when it comes to voter participation. But we need to also balance it out to make sure we're minimizing human error and we also are addressing any fraud potential. And this would allow us to do that. It's tying into an existing program that's in 70-plus counties. They call them e-poll books. They're laptops with voting information in there that would assure us that these persons who are voting are eligible voters. They are in the right precinct. And if they've already requested an absentee ballot or voted at the courthouse, it would flag that as well. We want to extend that to other counties. That's part of the bill. And the voter ID component is basically the ignition key. It's what turns it on. When the person comes in, they offer up their card and they just slide it through a barcode reader, and it identifies they are who they say they are. It gives them the pertinent data. It speeds up the experience and also assures us that we're reducing the human error, so you're not going through pages and pages of documents. For those who don't have a voter ID, which is about 5%, we would be sending them a free ID card. There's no photo on it. It's strictly about the barcode, and it's about a voter identification number. That's really the backbone of it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned human error and voter fraud. These are the two things that you're targeting here with these changes. Give us instances, and how prevalent are human error and voter fraud in the state?
Well, it's hard to measure the fraud portion because right now we don't have any kind of system in place to do that. There's no laws or criteria that requires counties to report that data back to us. What we collect is more informal, but we are well aware of some instances. We've had over a dozen counties who have turned over matters to the county attorney or sheriff for investigation.
If you don't have any data, though, what are you basing this on? Voter fraud has been looked at by many experts in the area nationally, and really the consensus, and correct me if with some data if you can, voter fraud is such an insignificant problem as to really not be a problem.
Well, again, what we're discussing here is not what my bill is focused on. My bill is focused on modernizing the process.
You also said it was to eliminate fraud and human error, and I'm just asking
correct.
You for the data, where the data comes from.
Let me finish. Mm-hmm. We have over a dozen cases that we are pursuing prosecution, and those counties are. We also literally have hundreds and hundreds of people who are registering on election day that we get kicked back, that their addresses aren't either legitimate or real. That's another issue. But based on what we have for technology today, we don't have the means to be able to follow up on every single person that's getting an absentee ballot to find out if they really are who they say they are. Compare that to Colorado, who just recently reported 21,000 cases on their mail ballots that they disallowed because the signatures didn't match appropriately. So they said they're not counting them. They have a mechanism. We have none. So I'm not leading this bill based on just fraud. I'm leading this bill on how to modernize the process, how to help the human error factor, how to speed the election process, and frankly, to make sure we don't have any fraud potential if we can by putting the safeguards in before the ballot goes into the box rather than finding out after the fact.
Mm-hmm. So when we spoke in November, and the setting in November was, there was a lot of rhetoric from our then candidate, current president, mm-hmm. About voter fraud, people voting more than once, dead people voting. But we spoke with you on election day on November 7th about whether that was a concern in Iowa. And I just want to replay 30 seconds of your answer there. You called our program, called the iVoters, a very good program. Let's listen to what you said in November.
I also would point out, I think what Mr. Trump talks about, and perhaps the public perception, is we still unfortunately have a few holdout areas where the party bosses, I'll call it, still dominate the elections process. And we need to get past that. Iowa's been very fortunate. We've had a very clean record here, one of the best in the country, and we're not going to let that change so that, everybody's on an equal footing. You know, the Democrats get a poll watcher, so do the Republicans. Both party gets a poll watcher there, but no one gets an edge.
Okay, Paul Pate, that was you on the last time on mm-hmm. our program. Back in November, let's go to some of our callers. Ben is in Des Moines. Hi, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say, and I'll take my response off the air, but I just feel like this is a kind of a solution in search of a problem. I feel like Iowa already has a really solid system of elections, and I feel like, and I appreciate, I read an article with Secretary Pates, trying not to make this overly burdensome for voters, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that he's trying to avoid some of the worst excesses of some of these photo ID laws in other states. I appreciate that. I thank him for that. But I still feel like this is creating an additional step that voters have to take on election day, and it's hard enough to get people to come out to the polls without giving them another thing to remember. So I really feel like these types of laws, however well-intentioned, ultimately discourage people from voting, and it tends to discourage people who are poor, people of color, marginalized communities. Those are the people whose votes are most likely to be silenced or discouraged by laws like this. So thanks so much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Ben. Ben says not a problem that doesn't need fixing. There isn't a problem, and he's worried about disenfranchising voters. What is your answer to that?
Well, again, I want to remind your listeners, if they go online, we have an overview of what the bill is. The bill itself is so much more than just voter ID. That's the sizzle everybody wants to talk about because that's politics. That's what's gone on for over a decade. Both political parties going back and forth over this whole idea of on voter ID, is it good or bad, is it disenfranchised? I'm telling you to get past that. I'm asking Iowans to look at what it does. Over 70 counties use it right now. So those counties aren't having a problem. No one's been disenfranchised. And I appreciate Ben's comments, but I think there's a little profiling going there, and that doesn't match the statistics. When we look at the individuals out there who are voting, we have a good cross-section across the board. And we look at those who don't have an ID card, it's clearly consistent across the board. Again, from 18 to 95 years old, it's the same number of people who don't have a driver's license. We're not reaching there's not one age group or one demographic who's being penalized because of this. It's a generic.
But wouldn't you admit that those who in this 5% I think you quoted, who are not likely or don't have some sort of ID already, they're likely to be demographically seen voters for the Democratic Party.
Well, I'm not sure I could go with that because I've never seen any hard numbers that affect. What I can tell you, though, is we're giving them the free ID card. They're not having to do anything. It's mailed right to them. And if you really look at it, those individuals who are on, the lower income side, if they're using any federal government program, they're having to have an ID for that already. So they've got some ID they're using to be able to access that program. I'm trying to remove as much of this political dialogue as one can and focus on the technology of elections. We have 2 million-plus registered voters in this state that we have to make sure they're accurate, they are eligible voters, and I want to do it in a way that doesn't disenfranchise. The database is what accomplishes that. On that database, we have all the crucial information that we need to access to make sure only eligible voters are there, and it puts the burden on us as administrators rather than disenfranchising the voter. The voter just comes in and does what the traditional ballot process. The only new twist here is a few counties who have not already had this will start using it.
You referenced a huge growth or a significant number of Iowa voters registering the same day. What would this new plan do to someone who for whatever reason, waits until Election Day, discovers they're not registered and would like to go vote?
Doesn't change anything. It's the present same as it is now. They would register and they'd be allowed to vote and we'd get them an ID card so that the next election they'd have it.
Would that be a provisional ballot
or
one that would count that day?
No, not under the present bill, it counts that day.
Okay. Let's get to some more feedback from our listeners. Timothy emailing, if you just joined us, Secretary of State Paul Pate is with us talking about a new voter identification proposal that he has that will be introduced, has been introduced last week, making its way through the legislature. Timothy emailing, how many people over the past 10 to 12 years have been charged with voter fraud or convicted?
Well, again,
going back to the data here.
Again, everyone wants to focus on this as strictly a fraud effort, this bill, and it is not primarily that. It is much, much more than that. If you want hard fraud numbers, then you need to give our office the ability to measure that and be able to pursue that information.
There is fraud out there, we just don't know about it. That's what you're saying.
Define fraud. Define fraud. Is it physical tampering of elections or
someone
is it influencing the campaign?
Someone voting multiple times, someone voting who shouldn't be voting?
I can tell you that we have serious numbers to deal with. I told you a moment ago that we have people who we call them kickback voter registrations where they don't match up and we can't track them down as existing voters. That is significant. And when you look at the felon issue, we've got that one turned around because we worked hard to prepare a good list of those folks who've had their rights restored. That's not been provided to all the auditors, but we still had, out of 50-some felons who did try to vote, we were able to capture 45 of those and stop them from voting. 5 did vote. Again, This is what we know for a fact. If we had the tools that were some of these tools we're asking for, I can give you a much harder number and it'd probably a little higher. But here's the bottom line. What is the magic number that tells you that fraud is a problem? Is it 1, 2, 3, 5, 100, 200? That's the political discussion that they're going to have. I'm choosing to approach this from modernizing the election process, trying to give our administrators the tools they need and also allow the voter to have a good experience while they're voting. I don't think there's anything in this bill that disenfranchises people at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say that it'll actually be a positive experience, just as we did online voter registration last January. That's been a positive experience. 70,000 Iowans stepped up and used it. Okay. What's the results? We actually had less people using electronic day voter registration, or excuse me, same day voter registration, because they did their registration online before they got there. They're using it. They're using the technology.
We have less than 10 minutes left with Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate. Last Friday on this program, Secretary Pate, we heard from Rita Bettis, interim program director and legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. I'd like to have you react to her comment on this proposal. Let's listen to some of what she had to say.
The talking points work a lot better than the actual bill as it's written. So it's not true that people wouldn't be disenfranchised or that people wouldn't be turned away or that this would make voting streamlined in any sense. So make no mistake, Paul Pate's voter ID bill, which is what it is, will make voting more difficult and more confusing for voters. It's also expensive for taxpayers. It would cost millions of dollars. The better it's implicated, the more public education that's provided for, the more voter outreach, the more expensive it's going to be. There are no funds available for that. There is no plan to even ask for funds for that. And of course, there's no justification for this. Iowa has some of the best elections in the country. We have some of the highest rates of voter participation and zero indication of any voter impersonation fraud.
Okay, a comment, react to Rita Bettis of the ACLU of Iowa.
I will be up front. She didn't have a single fact correct, not one. I don't know what she's reading. If she has a law degree, then she should go back and look at her law books because it's not even close. Okay. The fact is that...
Okay, what about the fact that what about the fact at the end that this is going to cost the state maybe $1 million?
Doesn't. That's why I said she didn't get a single fact right.
Explain the funding here, please.
The only funding involved here is the voter ID cards for those individuals who do not presently have a driver's license or a state ID. That's a one-time cost only. And the initial startup expense is going to be somewhere closer to the $400,000 range. And after that, it's minimal, $20,000 a year.
Where does the $400,000 come from?
It comes from the general fund, just like we pay for the other elections. Example, elections in Iowa right now are over $20 million a year we spend on an election. We're talking about $400,000 to implement these cards so that we don't disenfranchise voters, so we don't treat somebody to second tier, so we don't put them in a position where they have to be inconvenienced by going to someplace to get their card. It's, to me, a natural extension.
Tell us about yesterday's yesterday the Iowa State Association of County Auditors, this is a group, voted Friday. They made this known yesterday, to register against your bill. This is a group of key election officials in Iowa, people who know very well about our voting strengths and weaknesses. What's your reaction to this group of election officials coming out against the bill?
Well, I have to admit I'm disappointed that a very select group, it wasn't the association, it was an executive board, which does not speak for the whole membership. There are 99 county auditors who I've had conversations with, and for the most part, they do like many of the components in the bill.
So you're saying the board does not represent the group's opinion?
I'm saying they don't speak for 99 counties. Mm-hmm. I think if you spoke to the county auditors in more specific terms, what parts of the bill do they have an issue with and what parts do they support, we'd find that we have far more people supporting the majority of the bill than opposing it. And we're going to continue to work with the auditors. I've extended that from day one. We've involved them in the past, and we'll continue to do just that. And this is their chance to continue to give dialogue, and we'll see where we can go.
They said in their news release that they're forming a committee that would suggest changes to the bill. You're willing to incorporate their suggested changes?
I'm most certainly willing to listen to them. I need to see what those recommendations are, because at the present time, there are areas that we're addressing in this bill as a result of what we think are areas that need shored up. They may not share that same enthusiasm when we're talking about post-election audits. Right now, 30-some states do those. It's a process where the state would go in and look at these counties to make sure that they are conducting and doing all the procedures correctly. And there are many of those auditors who don't want us in there doing an audit. Well, you know, I understand that, but you know, to be fair about it, we need to do these audits. The state auditor does that for cities, counties, and school districts. And elections are, in my opinion, very important, too. So we'd like to be able to do that as well. And I think that's one of the areas they're resisting.
Kelly in Iowa City writing an email to us. She'd like you to address the 2014 investigation. This is before your time in office. This was under Secretary of State Matt Schultz. The 2014 investigation into voter fraud, which cost the state $250,000, found very few violations, mostly ex-felons, she writes, who had not jumped through the hoops to get their rights restored. In light of this and the intense budget debate, how can you justify spending money and resources on a voter ID initiative, asks Kelly. That investigation turned up very little after spending $250,000, right?
Well, I'm not going to be here to fight old battles. I wasn't the secretary then. I took the approach when I came into office of going out and making sure we had accurate lists put together, who these felons are, who had their rights restored, who is not, and we're using that system.
But if you have an investigation and you invest $250,000 of taxpayer money and you come up with virtually nothing, doesn't that indicate that there is a little problem?
Well, I think your definition of virtually nothing is not the same as mine.
So what is your definition of it? What do you think is out there?
We had significant numbers, my predecessor did, of names that were turned over to the counties for investigation and prosecution. We've seen many convictions as well. But what it really pointed out was just how bad and how poorly we've worded some of the process, and we're monitoring it. So we've had to step up on those areas as well. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm not going to fall into this political gotcha game where we go back and revisit my predecessor's efforts. Again, the people who don't want us to look at accountability and transparency keep trying to make this about politics. Mm-hmm. I have done my very best to take that out of this bill, to make it as technical as possible, to make it transparent as possible, to expect accountability from the auditors as well as the poll workers and our office and anyone involved. So I can't do much more than that at this juncture.
Okay. So your forecast is, how are you going to dispel at least the impression that that this is a partisan move? What will you do?
Well, I'm doing it right now by visiting with you and your listeners. I'm going to keep continuing trying to get the ACLU and others like them to actually use the facts when they're talking about the bill. There have been many who've jumped to conclusions way before the bill was in their hands. It's not their father's Buick. This is a much different approach than has been done in the past. And frankly, I think that frustrates the politicians out there who want to politicize it. We've tried to do a very good job of making this as professional and about hard procedures to make it a better experience for the voter, but also to make sure there isn't going to be fraud and there isn't going to be human error. And if there is, we'll know about it so we can correct it.
Secretary of State Paul Pate, from a February 7th, 2017 appearance on our talk show, River to River, hosted by Ben Kiefer. This is Under the Golden Dome from Iowa Public Radio, a weekly podcast about the legislative session. I'm John Pemble. Earlier in the week, during a public hearing for the voter ID bill at the Capitol, people are allowed to speak for or against it for a few minutes at a time. The first person was Secretary of State Paul Pate. This is his testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Masher and all the members of the House Government Committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. And I want to thank all of you Iowans who have come here tonight to make your voices heard as well. This is what a representative republic is all about, the free exchange of ideas. There are a few points I'd like to make clear. This bill is about modernizing our elections technology, streamlining the system, and securing integrity by preventing the potential for fraud or human error. It should also be easy to vote and hard to cheat. This bill accomplishes both of those goals, and I want to make that very clear in my short time today. No eligible voter will be denied their right to vote by this legislation. And I'm adamant about that fact and will fight to ensure voters are not disenfranchised. If you do not already have a form of ID, we will give you one for free automatically. I've worked very hard in my administration to help Iowans vote. We gave Iowans another simple way to register to vote last year when we instituted online voter registration, and 70,000 Iowans utilized the system to register to vote in 2016. We worked with colleges and universities across the state, the College Voter Engagement Drive, to encourage thousands of students to get involved in the process, and the program was a huge success. My office is a finalist for a national award for our Helping Veterans and Iowans with Disabilities Vote initiative. Studies show approximately 300,000 Iowans have some type of disability. We wanted to make sure they knew of all the resources available to them to help them register to vote and to cast their ballot, including curbside voting. My office conducted a statewide outreach effort and worked with groups like Disability Rights Iowa and the Iowa Developmental Disabilities Council, Operation Engage America, and many others to help Iowans with disabilities vote. And that initiative is one of the finalists for the Ideas Award from the National Association of Secretaries of State. I want every eligible Iowan to vote, and I will continue to strive toward Iowa being number one in the nation in voter participation. Nothing in this legislation will prevent any eligible Iowan from voting. It's disappointing that some folks have decided to politicize this issue, especially when poll after poll has shown overwhelming support for a voter ID program. In the Des Moines Register just 2 weeks ago, 69% of Iowans said they supported voter ID. That's Democrat and Republican numbers included. And those numbers hold true in every poll taken in Iowa nationally on the issue over the last several years. No one will be disenfranchised. I repeat, no one will be disenfranchised. For those Iowans who want to vote and don't already have a driver's license or a state-issued ID, we will send them one automatically for free with no extra effort required by them.
Mr. Secretary, yes. your time has expired. Thank you.
Just to my Senate days, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. Thank you.
Secretary of State Paul Paich, referring to his time as an Iowa senator from the 1990s. The American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa has consistently opposed this kind of bill. Offering testimony during the public hearing is Daniel Zeno from the ACLU of Iowa.
Voting matters. Voting is how we participate in our democracy. Voting is the right that black people fought and died for. This bill is an unnecessary, expensive bill that threatens to disenfranchise thousands. We all want integrity in our elections. And in Iowa, we're lucky we have that. The Secretary of State has said so repeatedly. Independent research shows that we have integrity in our election. According to the 2016 Perceptions of Electoral Integrity Survey, Iowa is ranked second in the country, right? And so we are lucky to have good election integrity. But there are also some other facts about Iowa. In Iowa, about 11% of adult Iowans don't have a driver's license or a non-operator ID. That's about 260,000 eligible Iowans who aren't accounted for in this bill. These numbers become even starker when we look at certain populations. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, 25% of African Americans nationally lack a government-issued photo ID, and that number tracks in Iowa. We know in Black Hawk County, for example, where there are a high percentage of African Americans make up 10% of the voting age population and 27% of the population without an ID. For Iowans, older Iowans, Iowans 65 and older, we know 15% of them lack an ID. Nationally, about 10% of people with disabilities lack an ID. And so we know certain people already don't have these IDs. Another example, domestic violence victims. One of the ways that some abusers affect their abuse is to keep people's documents. And so you could have a person who is registered, an eligible registered voter who can't vote because their abuser kept their license, kept their passport, kept their military ID, kept their free voter card, right? The everyday Iowan who's walking down the street and realizes, oh, today's election day, but I forgot my license and I ran to the elementary school to go vote. That Iowan wouldn't be able to vote anymore unless they ran home and hopefully got back to the poll in enough time. So we believe this bill would disenfranchise thousands of Iowans. I want to quickly talk about signature verification. This is also a problem. Obviously, people's signature changes day by day. People who are elderly, people who have disabilities, their signatures are more likely to change. And remember, we're talking about poll workers who are not handwriting experts comparing signatures. And in some instances, potentially deciding whether a person's vote counts. The bill also, we believe, effectively ends same-day registration, same-day voting for some Iowans. If you look at...
Thank you, Mr. Zeno. Your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
This public hearing lasts for 90 minutes, and there are more people that want to talk than there is time for, which is not unusual for an issue like this. As to the length of time while being debated in the House, well, that's a lot longer. The discussion lasts 12 hours in the chamber. It begins Wednesday afternoon. As the debate gets started, Representative Dennis Cahoon says the bill is an obstacle to voting.
I think the bottom line is that we have to ask ourselves, does this bill make voting easier or harder? I think it makes it harder, and that is not good for Iowa.
Representative Beth Wessel-Crochel says requiring an ID like a driver's license to vote, an ID one has to pay for, is the same as implementing a poll tax.
The need to pay to vote is unconscionable.
The first 2 hours revolve around an amendment saying voter identification laws are unnecessary, basically an amendment to shut down the bill. It is ruled not germane. The House breaks for 45 minutes and resumes at 6 in the evening. For 5 hours and 41 minutes, the House debates a single amendment, H. 1117. This would strike everything in the bill except the enacting clause. The amendment calls for impact studies for minority voters, women voters, rural voters, elderly voters, low-income voters, and student voters. It proposes these studies would be presented as a report from the state commissioner in 2018. The amendment is authored by Representative Amy Nielsen.
And we owe it not just to our citizens, but to ourselves, to know without a doubt that we have not kept even one vote from being cast. This is why I am asking that we take the time to study the impacts the overhaul of our current voting process would have on our citizens.
Representative Ken Reiser is the bill's floor manager, and he is asked to yield many times. Here is one from Representative Todd Pritchard about the bill's overall purpose.
I wonder if you could say kind of succinctly what the problem is in Iowa's voting system that you are specifically trying to address.
I think the primary problem is, well, there are two problems. One is voter confidence is low, and the auditors confirm that. And the other thing is that our system is still woefully outdated. You can go to a lot of precincts in this state, and they're still doing three-ring binders that are about this thick of voter lists.
Okay, do you think the confidence is low because there's widespread fraud in the system?
I think it's low because there is a perception of fraud, and I think that that confidence, that lack of confidence, is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Later, Representative Timmy Brown Powers asks Representative Reiser about the kinds of ID a citizen will need to vote.
If they don't have a photo ID, we're going to mail them a voter ID, correct?
Not exactly.
Can you explain that to me then?
Sure.
Thank you.
There are 5 acceptable IDs and 4 backstops or fail-safes.
Okay.
The 5 acceptable IDs are a driver's license, a non-operator ID, a military ID, a veteran's ID, or a passport. If they don't have any of those, then they can show the new voter registration card, which we will send out to all those people who do not currently have either a driver's license or a non-operator ID issued by the Department of Transportation.
So they can use that ID, but it won't have a picture on it.
That is correct, which is why this is a voter ID bill and not a photo ID bill.
Okay. But how much will that cost us to mail that ID out with that special number on it?
Yeah, it's a one-time cost, and the fiscal note that we received said that it would be $150,000 to send that out to the 85,000 people, approximately 5% of registered Iowa voters, who do not currently have either a driver's license or a non-operator ID.
Now, if they use that ID instead of a photo ID, they won't be disciplined at all at when they vote, correct?
Correct.
So that will go, I mean, they will use that card and they're
it's absolutely acceptable, and the new one is going to have a scan bar on that, so it can be scanned if they have e-poll books, and it will also have that unique confidential number on there that will follow them for the rest of the time they're here in Iowa.
Do we have any safeguards set up so that someone's not sharing that card with someone that maybe, you know, since there's not a photo ID, do we have any safeguards set up that card can't be shared?
We need people to keep track of their confidential information. It's just like a driver's license. A driver's license under Iowa code is a confidential document in that the number on there is reserved only for that person, so it has to be protected as such.
I was just thinking, since we're worried about fraud, you know, someone might give that card to someone, and since it doesn't have a picture on it, they actually could use it, and we may not necessarily know. We don't have a safeguard set up for that.
Well, you can never make a 100% fail-safe system. That is true. But having that is significantly better than what we have now, which is just somebody signs that they really are who they say they are.
The Democrats largely make their case about the need for more studies, but this amendment fails. Because the House rules prohibit debate past midnight, they adjourn until Thursday morning. After they start at 8:30 a.m., Republican House Leader Chris Hagenow calls for time certain.
Madam Speaker, I move that a time certain be set for the close of debate in the House Act on all amendments filed to House File 516 no later than 11 a.m. on Thursday, March 9th, 2017, and then immediately proceed to closing remarks on House File 516.
You have all heard the motion. Those in favor shall vote aye.
Aye.
Those opposed shall vote no. The ayes appear to have it, the ayes do have it, and the motion is passed.
Prior to this year, time certain was a rare procedural move. Earlier this year, Republicans used time certain in the House and Senate during a contentious debate about changing collective bargaining. You could say time certain is now part of the Republican playbook for the session. You could also say Democrats adding numerous amendments to extend debate time is part of their playbook. Thursday morning, as debate begins, the Democrats have 29 amendments. Representatives like Amy Nielsen suggest the bill will disenfranchise minorities.
This legislation is riddled with implicit bias. We've spent hours and hours trying to show you this. To deny the bias in this bill is completely disingenuous. And after everything you've heard over the past 12 hours, it's downright shameful.
The bill's floor manager, Representative Reiser, dismisses this claim during his closing remarks for the legislation.
When it comes to the issue of discrimination and voter ID laws, I go to the most credible source in the land. That's not the Washington Post. It's not a liberal or even a conservative think tank. It's the U.S. Supreme Court. And on this issue, the Supreme Court ruled on Indiana's voter ID law, and I quote, "This is a generally non-discriminatory voting regulation. The law's universally applicable requirements are eminently reasonable because the burden of acquiring, possessing, and showing a free photo identification is not a significant increase over the usual voting burdens." What's significant about this is this voter ID law that we are about to pass is significantly less restrictive than that that was passed in Indiana. So it's got to be non-discriminatory. And based on that, I have concluded that our bill is not racist. It is not discriminatory, and it does not suppress votes. Some of my colleagues in this chamber have implied that those of us who hold this view are racist and have even brought up that we're passing some sort of Jim Crow law. Disagree with me if you will, but to call those who simply disagree with you racist is itself racist and offensive.
The voter ID bill passes 58-4, 41 against, 1 not voting. The bill will move to the Senate. You're listening to Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. Week 9 was a very busy week at the Capitol. 4 packed public hearings, passage in the House of gun rights expansion, voter ID, and restricting a county's ability to set their own minimum wage. The Senate was also very active, but for this podcast, we're saving aspects of the stories we didn't get to for later. It's also worth note, much of the chamber activity happens at the end of the week. This comes right up against the deadline to make this show. That means we're kind of out of time to produce much more. One of the goals with this podcast is to take you inside the Capitol to get a better understanding of what is happening through longer sound bites and for you to hear words directly from the mouths of Iowa lawmakers. I'm John Pemble, the host of this series. We expect Under the Golden Dome to continue through the middle of April. The concept for Under the Golden Dome is from Iowa Public Radio News Director Catherine Perkins. Our News Director Michael Leland gives us editorial support. Stories for today's show comes from our reporters, Joyce Russell, Clay Masters, our talk show team, including host Ben Kiefer, and Kay Henderson from Radio Iowa is also very helpful with our legislative coverage. Week 10 may include legislation moving forward that will change how the Des Moines Water Works operates and what is the Senate reaction to the bills passed this week in the Iowa House. We'll include some of this when our next podcast comes out Friday afternoon from iowapublicradio.org.